go here. Boom. Okay, we've got 23 people at least. Amazing. Let's get Andy back on if he's there. Andy Lawson, boom. Yeah, no, thank you very much, Amanda. Appreciate it. I might be swearing at this point because we're having a proper disaster here. Andy, you back, mate?
Hey, yeah, you're all right.
All right, no worries. I literally, you just kicked me out. I'm criticizing you. You know what? I've never had a previous problem with this technology, but we've been so popular with regards to signups. I just got a pop-up to say we're oversubscribed again on the show. And I think they have a 250 view count limit. And if it goes beyond 200 if it goes beyond a certain number, they will basically have problems. So hopefully that's it. I think you did break the break the live stream. Catalina, I hope you can hear me. Please comment to say that you can. And if so, we'll be ready to go. All right, we're 42 people back on the show, which is fantastic. Andy, you've given a really good nugget already in terms of CVs as a potential negative indicator. What else might be a negative indicator? You're looking at a guy's profile, a girl's profile. What is it about it that you think actually there's a potential problem? I should really not eliminate the person, but potentially explore it further at a later stage.
Good question. I think when a CV, is kind of overly geared, it's overly talking about the things that we as a company did rather than the candidate as an individual did at their previous work, kind of talking about that, like, we are a brand that do these sorts of things and we sell this, rather than I built this piece of technology to help the business kind of make this step further forward, or I built a team, or these sorts of things. I tend to avoid.
You know what? That's really interesting, because I don't know whether you watched last week's show, when Mark Dubel, who is recruiting for software engineers, he was saying sort of the counterpoint to that: when messaging software engineers, you should actually talk about the job and the projects. But you're saying that actually, if the person's a candidate, that could be problematic, because that is what we're looking for, is someone with a bit of ownership, I guess, of what they're doing, rather than saying, hey, listen, it's the team that did this or the company did that.
Sure. I think that when you're looking at a candidate as an individual to kind of as kind of one of the many that you might talk to, I think an indicator of someone that might not have contributed to a project itself would be someone who overly talks on their CV about the company and what the company does. But I think I'd agree. I think that it's a good talking point to see how the person thinks about I guess solving business problems and like thinking about business impact and these sorts of things. I think it's a good conversation point.
Very interesting. Amy, I think I've got you back. How are you? Are you here? Oh my goodness, I'm so excited.
Can you hear me? I had to change devices and everything. Anyway,
you know what? You're here, and I'm really pleased. And what a mess this has been. I do apologize for kind of bouncing you around the internet there a little bit. But we definitely had a bug with the software, and then some reason it worked and it didn't. But anyway, you know what? It's bizarre, because obviously this is a tool that's designed for a certain number of people. The last two shows with Aaron last week, we had 600 people. This week we've got 300 people plus sign up. It's kind of busting the live stream, which is exciting, but also not great. Anyway, Amy, now that we've got you on, for the few people that might not know you, I wonder whether you could just quickly introduce yourself and what it is.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Amy Miller. I'm a technical recruiter. I've worked for 3 out of the $4 trillion companies. So that's exciting. I've been in big tech for probably about 10 years or so, and I am the least technical tech recruiter on the planet. So when I was invited to this, I was a little terrified, because I have no idea what I'm doing half the time, but that's okay. It'll be fun.
So, I mean, this is an interesting conundrum for us recruiters, isn't it? Because we're not technical, but we have to recruit technically. And, and I'm of the belief that we don't need to necessarily be domain experts, but we need to be, I would call it domain fluent. Like, we kind of know what we sort of what the things are without necessarily being an expert at doing the job. And I just wonder what degree of technical literacy you would sort of expect a recruiter to possess, a tech recruiter to possess.
Yeah, I mean, a tech recruiter needs to know that, first of all, somebody like our friend Andrew is going to see through my BS if I try to pretend that I'm really technical. Like, that's, you know, I would expect someone to be able to understand just the fundamentals. Like, clearly a front-end developer is not necessarily going to want a back-end developer job. I mean, some of those things are just kind of simple and Wikipedia is your friend. But the idea, like, what I want is I want somebody that's really good at reading people. Like, I want a tech recruiter that can understand if a candidate knows what they're talking about. So if I say, hey, walk me through your last project and what tools you use and how often you were, you know, actually hands-on coding versus reviews and design discussions and things like that, I should be able to pick up on the cues and things that tell me that you know what you're talking about, and then somebody else can further vet for the actual technical expertise, like actually having a code review and things like that. But it's more important for me that my recruiters know how to read people and kind of read between the lines and know if somebody knows what they're saying than somebody who can actually get in and write code themselves.
Right. So it's almost like spotting, if you like, a fabrication or someone who's as an exaggeration, let's say, which, you know, we know that. Yeah. In a sort of when you're doing interviewing for jobs, we're all prone to do that. You want someone to be able to spot what those are rather than you know, have necessarily the technical know-how to do to do the job.
Yeah, absolutely. You should be able to point me to projects. You should be able to, you know, show me your GitHub repository. I know Aaron has clients that love that and want to see it first. So I should be able to just kind of pick up the signals that the data is there and the meat is there. It's not for me to tell you if you're a good coder or not. That's not going to be my expertise. But I can tell you if you know what you're talking about, if you're interested for the role, because it's not just the technical expertise. Is this person have a real chance of potentially moving through the process and really going to consider an opportunity with us? So there's all that other emotional currency at work that we have to pick through. It's not just, can this person write code? Although that is an important question. Can they code?
In terms of moving on to what we would review, obviously we would review a CV, I would review background. Andy mentioned something really interesting about looking for negative signals, potentially someone who stayed too long in a particular job or a technology. Do you have anything to add to that? Have you found any patterns in your work that you would say, you know, not definitively, but you could say, hey, listen, this may be a little bit of a flag, a red flag that I need to investigate further.
No, for sure. And just thinking about the last two companies that I worked at, there was definitely concern sometimes around like what he's saying about growth. Like, have you actually taken on, it's not necessarily being promoted. Not everybody's going to go into management. We're not saying everybody has to go be a leader, but have you taken on progressively larger projects? Have you done bigger things? Have you had a bigger scale impact in your work? So that's one thing that we look for. And the second thing we look for is, are you building and developing new things? If you're just keeping an old 15-year legacy system alive, that's great. And there's definitely jobs out there for people that do that. I've not recruited for any of them personally. I've typically worked and recruited for roles that were kind of looking for that V1 stuff, or, you know, taking an idea and turning it into a product or service that we can monetize. So those are two big things that I look for.
Yep. Interesting. What about, let's take it to our friend GitHub, you know, I think maybe, 10 years ago, probably very few people would even be aware of sort of the idea of what GitHub is. Now it's becoming a default. I think there's very few tech recruiters that wouldn't know what that is. And they wouldn't know that it's important for developers in the hiring sort of process. What is it that you think is important to look at in GitHub, if at all? I mean, Andy, let me take this one to you firstly. Everyone's got a GitHub profile, isn't that right? I mean, what would you look for if you saw it?
So everyone's got a GitHub account, I guess. Like, we use GitHub at work all the time, and it's an important tool for us at work. But I think it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that A good engineer is someone who is really passionate about engineering and is a like a hobby engineer and these sorts of things, which I think is often quite obvious in someone's GitHub profile, that you can see they've got lots of projects or they contribute to lots of other projects. And I don't think it's a bad indicator to show that someone is really interested in coding, but I don't think it is the indicator to show that someone is a good coder or is really interested in coding as a career versus as a hobby.
So why do you say that, Andy? That's interesting. I'd love to explore it a little bit more.
So I suppose maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I also probably spent a lot of time kind of working on my GitHub profile because I knew a lot of tech recruiters were going to look at this profile. And really what it did was it distanced, I suppose, myself from the work that I was doing at work versus the work I was doing outside of work. And it was kind of healthy to have lots of projects going on for a while. But then I think that, I don't know, as my career progressed, as I grew older, I suppose, coding as a hobby became less of a thing. And I don't think that necessarily showed that I was less interested in coding. It just meant, or that I was less good at coding. It just showed that I just didn't have that time to spend on my GitHub profile for, I don't know, it almost felt like, it felt like a very strange reason to kind of do these things.
You know, you've mentioned something really interesting. I'd love to do an age breakdown on the sort of most active people on GitHub, because I just wonder whether this might have something to do with your life progression, you know, because if you're like, oh, obviously you're free, single, totally motivated, you know, absolutely narrow focus, you don't have kids, you don't have mortgage, you don't have any of these things, maybe yes, you can do lots of stuff on the side. But you know, you have kids, you suddenly have a mortgage to pay, you got to take the kids to football, all this type of stuff. You might not have the time to start building out your GitHub profile. Doesn't mean you're a worse developer. It just means you've got a more rounded life.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, and that's also a positive thing to bring to work, having a much more rounded life than just spending like 80% of your time writing code. Because even 80% of an engineer's time at work isn't just writing code. It's about a whole load of other things like communication and working with people and kind of leveling others up and all these sorts of things. It's outside of writing code, and code is the only real thing that you get to see on GitHub.
You know what? This is a really important discovery. Amy, I'm going to go to you because you are a parent.
Yeah.
It just totally occurred to me that all of the recruiters are probably looking, oh, he or she's got a crap GitHub profile, or potentially inactive or dormant. Mm-hmm. But you know what? This person may have simply moved on in life. You know, they've done.
I mean, I have 4 kids. I'm on day 3 of not washing my hair. Like, believe me, there's no time for that stuff. So no, but I think that's a good point at what Andy's saying about just kind of tenure. So I look at it like this, that GitHub and the repositories and the projects and the things that you're doing there, we're looking ultimately for some kind of signal that you can do the job. Right. And so in the very early days, and somebody had asked a question about boot camp, which I'm fine with boot camp folks. Again, it's about, do you have the right skills and abilities, and do we get those signals from your resume, your GitHub profile, your LinkedIn profile, whatever. The further you get in your career, the more that signal shows up in your actual work versus showing up on side projects or on GitHub or on any other non-work kind of thing. So I think for the early stage folks, again, the ones that maybe don't have kids and mortgages, you have more time to build that. And that's part of building your professional profile. But if you've been coding for 10 years and you've worked for a couple of well-known companies, it's probably not as important, again, depending on the company, because there's certainly some companies that really live and breathe it and others don't. So you have to know your audience.
Yeah, very, very interesting. This has actually blown my mind a little bit, because I've always been suspicious of GitHub itself, but not really understood why. Simply because I've encountered great developers that, you know, aren't particularly active there for whatever reason. And on the opposite side, you see developers that are super active there, and you know, you do wonder, you know, how much commitment they are giving to their day job. If you know, they're spending all their time, you know, ranking up the followers and the stars. So that's very interesting. Going back to the beginning, though, GitHub profile, if I was to look at it, are there any negative signals? Are there any positive signals that, you know, a youngish tech recruiter might kind of start looking at and picking out? Andy, I'll go to you with that
question. I'm trying to think. I don't know.
I'll tell you, I'm more concerned if somebody is bragging about their GitHub and doesn't have anything to back it up. I mean, just don't bring it up if it's not going to help you. And again, I don't have clients, at least right now, that care a lot about it. But it's one of those things, either if a client really, really cares about it, make sure that you're beefing it up and it's legit. Or if you're just not in a place to do that, you know, stage of life, busyness, whatever, don't tell me you are, because I'll find out. And I know people that can check the tech stuff for me. I don't have to do it myself. But yeah, so that would be my only caveat. Like, if it's legit, great. If it's not legit, don't even bring it up.
Yep. How about you, Andy? Any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I think there's also, you also get kind of, I suppose, funny projects, which, I don't know. Like, I think there is kind of lots of different types of projects. You get like a project that is clearly just for fun, and someone's done something like funny or crazy or whatever, and put it on the internet, and then they get like a million stars or whatever it is, and everyone's enjoying it. That's kind of one project. You also get other projects that are kind of more useful, more technical, more I don't know, could be used in that person's day job, in other people's day job. And I think it's always important to kind of take both of those types of projects into account. It's always good to have some fun with some tech, and it's also good to kind of do something that actually kind of could count towards someone's work or someone else's.
I think what you're being very polite about and saying, Andy, is that there's a lot of like developers that have got lots of technical flair, let's say, but they're producing like peacock type projects, you know, look at me type projects, but actually this doesn't apply to the real world. Or it applies to a vanishingly small, maybe technically brilliant, but it literally there's going to be a very small amount of possible use cases for this, compared to someone who might be doing something a little bit more mundane, maintaining a, you know, an old legacy system, or doing something that is potentially not, you know, sexy, if you want to use that term, but actually is contributing to the wider community. And I think the reason why I think I understand this is because this happens in recruiting, doesn't it, Amy? You know, you see a lot of, especially if you've got like me, you've got a lot of conferences and stuff like this, and you see a lot of wonderful talks. And oftentimes some of them are really great, you know, innovative technical flourishes, and you think that's amazing. Mm-hmm. But then you think, am I really going to use that? I mean, is it even usable? You know, technically sounds great, right, but I'm never going to deploy that. It probably is not going to be that important to that many people. Whereas in fact, there's a lot of people doing, you know, less interesting, quote unquote, operational work that is actually much more valuable and substantial.
Honestly, like, are we getting shit done or not? Like, that's the question in my mind. Am I allowed to say that on your show?
You're absolutely allowed to say that. It's a not safe for work show.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, yep. I just, you know, again, do we have the signal, the data, the proof that you can actually do what we need you to do? Can you ship a feature? Can you build a project? Can you take an idea and turn it into something that we can monetize? Like, those are the questions. And again, I think, I know there's been some comments about how even technical recruiters need to understand the source code or have a general, like, no, I don't. I don't have time. I have 4 children and a full-time job and 3 dogs. It's not happening. But I do have great partnerships with my hiring managers and my technical experts. And I can take 5 minutes and, hey, this is what I think I'm hearing. This is what I'm understanding from this. Am I right? And I've been doing it long enough to know that my gut's usually right.
Moving on from looking at profiles, at some point, there's going to be a conversation. Is there any value in a telephone screen? I see a developer, I see great profile, I see great trajectory, all those things tick the boxes. Is there any value in me and that person having a telephone conversation? Amy, I go to you with that.
Yeah, so are we talking a telephone screen with a recruiter or a hiring manager or both?
Great point. I would say recruiter first. So non-tech to tech phone conversation.
So that's where the content of the phone screen is so important, right? I am not going to get on a call and have them solve a data structure problem. Like, that's not a question I'm going to ask. I'm going to ask things like, tell me about your last project. Tell me the coding languages you're most familiar with, ranking them from favorite to least favorite or most used to least used. How long have you been doing something like this? Those are kind of the questions that I'm asking. I'm not asking them to sit on a whiteboard virtually and solve a problem for me. I want to uncover the non-tech stuff. We sometimes forget that. We get so focused on solving for, oh, is this person the right coder and do they have the right skills and can they write in the right languages? But we're forgetting to talk about things like, why would you change jobs? What is it that I would need to offer you aside from money, even though money is important, to make a change? So all of those things in the initial call, and remembering that we're not hiring just a developer, we're hiring an entire person who develops or who codes. So that's the importance of the phone screen. And then I save the really deep technical stuff for the hiring manager phone screen. So if we agree that we feel like the right signals are there and we're thinking this could be a good fit, and yeah, you're at least open to the next conversation, that's when you get on the phone with the hiring manager or a technical delegate. And that's when you have a much deeper technical conversations to continue to vet for the more, you know, technical expertise.
Yeah, so that makes perfect sense for me, Amy. I love the way you described that. It's about understanding sort of the motivations of the human being, because ultimately this person is going to be making a potentially very significant decision. And understanding what they want to do. You know, it's not about how competent you are per se in these languages. That is for the technical people to figure out. But are you motivated to do more of this language? Because this is the job that requires you to do that language.
Yeah.
So those types of things, I think recruiters are definitely well equipped for. I got a question. I'll stay with you, Amy, for a second, because this is one of the challenges I think recruiters have. Technical managers, hiring managers, put a huge amount of pressure on recruiters to not introduce them to candidates that they deem to be technically unsuitable. And that sometimes that can force sort of the recruiters can succumb to that pressure and they can attempt to try and figure out whether they're technically strong enough or not. How would you advise a young recruiter in their in their career who's encountering this type of pressure from the hiring manager? How do they have that conversation and push back on that?
Yeah, and I guess I have the benefit of age, lots and lots of age, but I'm not an order taker. You're not going to come to me and give me a spec and say, go find me somebody that can do these things, and I'm going to go scurry off and find someone that can do these things. We're going to sit down and figure out, first and foremost, what is the business problem we're trying to solve? What is the talent needed to solve said problem? What is that going to look like in a profile and or a resume? What are some high level technical questions that I can ask and the appropriate answers-ish to know that this is the right kind of person? And oh, we're going to do this about 3 or 4 times, and then we're going to sit down and we're going to go through all 3 or 4 of those, and we're going to vet it very carefully before I go find you some more. So this is not a one way, like I'm just going to go find people that have the right keywords and let you say no repeatedly. If you say no 3 times, we're having a conversation before you see anyone else.
Yeah, very important. I mean, Andy, from your side, you've been a hiring manager. And I'm not saying that you've ever pressured recruiters, not to waste your time, but of course that's something you've got to preserve. You've got to look after your own time. So how do you have a conversation with a tech recruiter so that you actually, you know, legitimately get them to do a job they can do, but at the same time, you know, not putting stuff through to you that you know is not going to be a right?
So I think it's important for engineers and other technical people to be involved early in the stages of technical hiring.
Yes.
I think leaving it too late in the process, it just adds to the cost. Even though people think that you can kind of like build this bubble around your technical team and kind of only put candidates that they think are correct in, like it ultimately just costs more, I think. So I think having people in from the engineering teams early in the process makes much more sense.
How early is early?
So the way we hire right now is we get some of our engineers to join in on the initial calls that we have, and rather than kind of trying to work out loads and loads and loads of technical stuff, we try and dig deep on like a specific thing and just keep asking kind of more and more questions about this one specific thing to see how they solve a problem. And pretty much that's what we're looking for. We're looking for people that can solve a problem, and that's all.
Yeah, so basically, it's not covering every single bit of technology in the environment. It's really a tech-agnostic, if you like, approach. You're looking for problem-solving mentality. And how do you choose the narrow area? I mean, is this something that you guys decide, or do you do it in collaboration with the candidate? How does that work?
Yeah, so I just want to say the only thing that we care about is the digging deep and kind of figuring the problems out. We kind of have a conversation around that to kind of talk about like the things that they want to do and the things that they've worked on, and kind of those sorts of questions. And from those questions, we can work out like the project that they like to talk about, and we can start to talk about that project and like how it's designed and what they, you know, if they were to redesign it, or if they were to kind of carry on working on it, how would they change it and how would they work on it, and just keep going down almost like a tunnel of kind of questions, I suppose, into whichever area of previous work or kind of hobby work or whatever it is that they like to talk about, just keep talking about that.
This sounds to me that it's kind of moves it on to the next phase, really, which is, well, what is the next phase after a telephone conversation? I'm presuming there's a sort of a deeper diagnostic at some point. But you're saying, which I would always say is that tech to tech type conversation, as you mentioned, Amy, at some stage, mm-hmm. you need to get the hiring manager or the technical member of the team to have some sort of dialogue with this person. Now, how does that dialogue take place? Is it best via a telephone call? Is it best via video like we're doing now? Do you get the person in? We talk about whiteboards. I think they used to be popular, and then we kind of completely swung the other way. Now we all hate whiteboard tests. How do we do this? You know, what is the best format for tech-to-tech diagnostic of competence?
I mean, and there's, you know, virtual whiteboards, right? Like a collab edit or something like that. So you can do a video and share a screen. So I think there's value there. So yeah, I think, you know, and again, it goes back to, did we kind of already kind of vet what we think we know, and do we have kind of the right initial signal to say this is worth the engineering hour that we're taking away, right, to have this person do this call? So I'm a fan of video and kind of the virtual whiteboard whenever possible. But really the whole idea is we're trying to get to the point where we see enough value in bringing this person in and spending 7 engineering hours going through the interview and really capturing the full data. So it should be a screening in process, because you're really getting the full package in the interview. So yes, I think there are some signals you can get in the phone screen or in a virtual whiteboard screen or whatever. But hopefully we're asking the right questions, and we're looking for, you know, is this person teachable? And, you know, somebody might have been coding in Java for, you know, their whole life or their whole career, and we're a C# house. Well, that's okay. I mean, those are somewhat, you know, if you can do one, you can do the other, I've been told. So, you know, are we looking at the right signals? And then are we just gathering enough information to interview? We're not making a hire decision. We're making an interview decision.
Yeah, so basically that's quite an important distinction, I think, Amy. So thank you for that. You're not looking to say this is hire ready. You're looking mm-hmm. to say this person right. can progress to the next stage because there's enough in there, or we don't know enough to say a no. We need to, because sometimes it's ambiguous, right? It may be there's in similar sort of style to our sort of start to this show, we had a bunch of technical problems that caused everyone to be anxious. Inevitably, that would impact how people mm-hmm. might quote unquote perform during this assessment. So if you don't factor that type of stuff in and have I would say a more permissive attitude to these assessments, understand they're all flawed, then I think that would be kind of a better way to think about how these types of tools work. Andy, I let you go on.
I was going to add to that. So I also think it kind of works the other way too. So I think, well, as like a hiring team, we're looking to see if the candidate is ready to go into the next phase so we can spend some more time on them. I think a candidate is also looking for the company, for the interview, to also invest that extra time at the next stage too. So I think to have like a very thin kind of initial call or initial kind of phone screen or whatever it is with a candidate, if they can tell that they're kind of, that a company is doing this almost on the cheap and kind of just like they've got a pile of CVs and they're throwing them through and kind of just like really sifting through them, the candidate is likely to not want to spend the next time kind of with that company. They're not going to want to do the coding challenge or come in for an interview or whatever it is, because mm-hmm. it's also a large investment for a candidate too.
Absolutely.
Right. So you've actually brought a really important point. What is the assessment load for the candidate? I forget the name of the fellow who recorded on a spreadsheet, right? Which he basically counted the number of minutes and hours that he spent getting involved in looking for a job. And he was a highly skilled, he might have been an Amazon engineer actually. So he was like super popular. And he ended up being like, obviously parallel process. Everyone wanted to hire him, but he was monitoring, wow, here is the commitment I'm getting asked to do. And he ended up with a ridiculous number of hours that if he was to go through them all, he would have to do like three times the amount of work that he would do in a week. And obviously you can't do that. So this type of signaling, I think, when you're talking about that every touch point, it's a two-way reciprocal process where either side is really just capturing a bit more information to see whether it's worthwhile to take the next step. It's not a guillotine yes, no, unless there's an obvious reason why there's an incompatibility.
Yeah, totally agree.
What about things like technical tests? What are our views on that? Are they useful? What is a good technical test? What is the difference between take home online? What is the difference between, you know, something you bespoke compared to something that, you know, for instance, our sponsors are Codility. They do a kind of a classic benchmark. What is your view on that side of things, Andy?
I think that take home tests are a really important part of technical hiring. I think it shows. It shows a lot of things. I think that I prefer to look at a technical test as almost like a series of, trade-offs. You're looking for the trade-offs that the person has made versus, like, I'm not looking for perfect code. I'm not looking for a perfect solution to a problem that I've given them. I kind of don't really care about that stuff. I want to see how they've made their trade-offs, where they've made their trade-offs, and how do they communicate how they've made those trade-offs and why.
Can you just sort of dumb it down for me? What trade-offs, what do you mean?
So by a trade-off, I mean, so in engineering life, in day-to-day kind of working life, we have deadlines, we have requirements to meet, we have all these sorts of things, and we're always looking to build iteratively so we can meet some deadlines and we can kind of continue to show progressive improvement. And I think that we should be able to demonstrate the same thing in a technical test. We should be able to show that I was given this problem, I've solved this problem, and now I can iterate and make this bit better and iterate and make this bit better. And I was given 2 hours to build this whole thing. So this is how far I got of those iterations in that 2 hour period. I don't want to build the perfect thing first time and dump it.
Yeah, and in fact, an attempt to build the perfect thing first time is an indication that this person may not understand the issue of trade-offs, right? So, I mean, exactly. If you are giving a deadline of 2 hours, man, you've got 2 hours to do this. If he's sort of engaged in the approach that would take 20 hours, you know what? That's probably something he needs to look at as an engineering discipline, because it's not about perfect code, as you mentioned. It's about providing a practical solution. So, super interesting. What about your view on sort of the idea of a take-home test and the idea of kind of an online test? Is there a difference? What is good, what is bad about either or?
With the online ones, my experience with online tests are that you're given a problem and they're usually around data structures or algorithms, and you either solve or you don't solve, and it's right or it's wrong. And I find that's quite... it's almost like that guillotine you were talking about before. You've either done it or you haven't done it. And I don't think that's a great way to judge how somebody solves a problem in day-to-day engineering life. I don't think there's a right answer or a wrong answer.
So your preference would be what? Self-design test or a team-generated thing, something like that?
It doesn't have to be a very involved or very complex, or it doesn't have to be anything special. We have a very simple problem, or a basic kind of sounding problem. Solve the problem however you think seems fit. And hopefully we can have a good conversation following that about the trade-offs that person's made.
Cool. Amy, I'm going to come to you on this, because I think here we have actually the trade-off in the recruitment side, mm-hmm. right? Because creating, if you like, custom tests and getting that adds costs for the team to build that, and mm-hmm. it adds costs for the team to then review it, because it's a custom test. Sometimes they don't have the time. So maybe that's when we need to make the trade-off of a slightly less optimal solution, but at least it's off the shelf. Like you can go to an online platform and say, right, this may not be, you know, again, using your term, Andy, absolutely perfect, but it's worth the trade-off because it means it saves my engineers this amount of time, and it's much better than just simply, you know, going on gut feel or going on interview or what have you. What are your thoughts on that, Amy? Have you encountered that scenario?
I'm all over the place with this, to be honest, because I think on the one hand, it's an opportunity to level the playing field a bit, right? If everyone is going through the same process and we know that there's kind of a single way that we're calibrating potential hires, I think in some ways that's a good thing, I think, because on the other hand, maybe you're really good at taking a test, or maybe you're like me and you get absolute utter test anxiety and bomb every time, even if you know the subject inside and out. So there are trade-offs. I think, like Andy said, the engineering leader should be involved in helping us kind of build this. And what are we really trying to solve for? What is the answer that we're trying to get by asking this question? So I'm not anti-tests, but I think use with caution. I think we have to be very, very clear that we're just simply trying to find a baseline, like, yes, this person knows how to write code, to keep it really, really simple. And then the rest of it, the problem solving, the communication, all of that kind of stuff, I don't think you're going to get in a written test. I think also to your point about, you know, take home versus online or whatever, I've not experienced it, but I've certainly heard horror stories about people taking it home and having someone else take the test. So I know different solutions have ways to solve for that. And there's, you know, logins or whatever, but you know, it can be really tricky. So it's a slippery slope. And I think all of those things have to be taken into consideration. And then what's in it for the candidate? If the first or even second step is for me to do some kind of homework for you, I don't know that I like you that much yet. I don't know that I'm that invested in this opportunity to go through that. So what have you offered me, or what have you given me, to your point about the gentleman who was tracking his hours? Like, why should I invest in this test after the first call? And you know, you're a junior recruiter who's basically gone down a list of questions and you haven't engaged with me. So those are my concerns.
You know what? I'm guilty as charged. I used to do that back in my early days before I understood. You know, it's like, oh yeah, here we have a technical test, and then you send them it. And I was getting feedback from people saying, yeah, look, Hung, you know, I really like the business, etc. But this is going to be like a weekend's worth of work. And I thought, okay, that's actually quite a lot of work. And you only have 52 weekends in a year, and I'm asking this guy to sacrifice that for no pay for the potential of being offered this job that I approached him for. All of these things sort of start percolating, and you think, okay, when is it the optimal time to deploy or ask someone to do a technical test? And it's way down the line, isn't it? It's way down the line. Is it before you meet them, or is it after, do you think?
We always do a call with an engineer to kind of help with the idea of, like, with that investment, we're investing time into the candidate, and we're not only investing time from our hiring team, we're also investing the time from our engineers, and kind of we can have like a really good in-depth conversation with an engineer and the candidate together. And I suppose the hope is that it gets the candidate to kind of feel that they've been invested in, and so they're a bit happier to invest to that time. It is kind of, we do send the technical test out before we've met them in person, but we'll talk to them via like Hangouts before we send it out. That's how we do it.
Yeah, I think I like the idea of thinking about it in terms of energy in, energy out. Like if you've reciprocated the amount of energy you're asking that individual to do this test, then I think that's okay. But if you've literally just called them 5 minutes or whatever and you pinged them a test, that is not okay, because you're asking way more than 5 minutes worth of call. So I think that concept, kind of similar to candidate experience and feedback and rejection and stuff like this. I know for a big company like Amazon, there's probably no way you could reject every single applicant that comes through in a personalized way with feedback. You know, very difficult to do. Come on, that's not possible. But at the same time, someone who's kind of you've taken through deeper into the process that has invested hours of time, then of course that's when you need to amp up the feedback and you need to amp up whatever. So I think the reciprocity of energies and it is an important thing to think about. Okay, I'm going to bring good move on to the next part, because I want to bring on Janko Strasburg. He was great last week, and he was talking about sort of getting people to kind of collaborate as a method of assessment. So we talked in the first instance of, okay, we've got these set piece tests to, you know, figure out whether they're good or not. But all tests of any type, they're all kind of proxies, really, of the job that you need this person to do. Is there any scope to just get him to do some of the job? I mean, I'm interested to explore that. I'm not sure actually whether Janko's had this direct experience, but I'll bring him on anyway and see what he thinks about it. He works for Elastic, which is a remote working you know them, Andy. Is I'm sure we all know them now. We're all fairly fluent with the tech side, but they're a database that, and as a business, they are 100% remote. So I'm quite interested to know what impact that is. There is no concept of bringing this person into the office, for instance. So how do we assess for that type of person, you know? So, hey, there's Janko again. Janko, how are you doing, sir?
Hey there. Doing well. How is everybody?
Very well. Sorry that's kind of delayed to bring you on, but obviously, you know, we had 10-15 minute chaos at the beginning of the show, Janko. Thanks for coming with us, coming along with us the second iteration of it. I don't know whether you heard about this, but I'm interested to know how you would assess someone when you're in a remote kind of environment, because most of us are working co-located and we seem to have sort of a process where we are building up towards an in-person event. Now, how does it all work when the company is entirely distributed and there may never be an in-person event? Like, how do you go and recruit? Does it change in any way?
Well, it's complicated because basically, as you say, we don't really meet up. So a lot of interviews, they are completely remote. So I have been interviewed completely remote. I've been hired and I only met my teammates in person like half a year later or something. And I also do some screening and some hiring processes for our team. So we actually have multiple rounds. We have multiple engineers that actually speak with the candidate as well. And we see what kind of, how do they react to typical questions of ideas of scenarios. How do you attack a problem? How do you solve something? How do you investigate things? And it's quite interesting, but it's also a bit scary, as in somebody from the internet gives you a job, sends you a job contract at some point, and you start working not having seen anybody. In some places we have like offices, shared co-working or so, then it's easier, but sometimes it's just not possible.
What is the difference in terms? I mean, I think it's fascinating. I don't know whether, I mean, I'm talking a lot, but Andy, I'd love to get your views on this, because working in an entirely distributed manner, I mean, how would you feel if you were interviewed, you know, kind of potentially offered without having ever met anybody? Is that something that's okay?
It's a really good question. It's not something I've experienced before. I've certainly done some parts of interviews remotely, but never the full interview experience remotely. It's something that I guess we're also trying to work on at Monzo and trying to figure out exactly how we do full remote hires, I guess. Because I guess I think that it's a really good way to really expand properly is to really treat remote working as like a first class or distributed working as a first class way of working, rather than as like this second thing that only a few of our engineers do. But yeah, I really don't know.
It's an interesting, isn't it? Because I think all of the recruiting processes that we've set up are generally set up with the default of permanent on-site full-time in mind. But suddenly we're starting to see these kind of next gen tech companies that have always been distributed. You know, Elastic is one, Automatic, Basecamp, all of these companies that literally don't have offices, never met each other. You know, how do we assess people? I mean, a lot of things co-located companies doing, what can we learn from these remote businesses? What are your thoughts on this, Amy? Do you think there's anything that we could really pick up from these guys?
Yeah, I think video can do a lot. I mean, it's not exactly the same, but my boss is in Sunnyvale, right? My a lot of my team sits in Sunnyvale because we're building out this new team up here in Bellevue for the business I work for. And so, yeah, I basically was hired not having met anyone. I met everybody on video, aside from obviously the local recruiters that I'll be sitting with. It was all very, like, I was never face-to-face with my boss until I was about a week and a half in. But I felt like I knew her because we'd had so many phone conversations and we'd had, you know, some video chats. And so for me, it was a no-brainer. I'm a huge fan of remote. I'm sitting here in my home office, as you can see. So I don't think in person is that critical. I know it's probably not a popular opinion, but I'm perfectly fine with this format.
Thanks for that, Amy. I think we're getting towards that point, aren't we? Where I think most of us are familiar with video, we're familiar with day-to-day life, yeah, and so on, and actually it works more or less okay. Yanko, I just want to go with you on a few more points on this, particularly when it comes down to a technical assessment. So you do a lot of, you have multiple technical interviewers having conversations, I guess, with these folks. Do you get involved in any type of collaborative work before you make the hire, or is it sort of done through the conversation route? Like, do you pick up enough information through these multiple conversations to make a decision?
Yeah, we generally manage to do that this way. So I don't know, apart from maybe our like proper programming hands-on jobs where you need to do some assessment kind of stuff. But in lots of places, it's basically really just done screening their details, having multiple interview rounds, and being directly assessed by like a large amount of your direct peers in the future. So you see, first of all, the technical skill sets, where they are, what kind of experience they have, but also if they are fit in the team itself, which is quite important. And then, I mean, for being completely remote, it's complicated because we have a ramp up period of like 2 months, 3 months, depending. And until you show that you might or you might not be able to do something, it's also taking a while. But yeah, we're quite good at screening, I would say. So whatever I get as an interview candidate, basically, that has filtered through lots and lots of filters, normally quite high quality already. So, and then you can sometimes judge. There was a question about graduates. So that's exactly our issue. Juniors are not that easy to work into these kind of environments. And also, you can't train somebody just by video call that easily as if you have them sitting next to you in the office. So that's still something we're working on as well.
Yeah, so yeah. That's an interesting dimension. So remote work might lend itself a little bit more to someone who is a bit more tenured, and therefore has higher functional confidence simply because of the time they've spent. And if you're entry level, they're going to need more intensity of knowledge transfer, which is best achieved through, you know, the over the desk stuff. So super interesting. Interesting you mentioned this, because I also now want to bring on a friend of mine who is working at sort of building a community of junior developers. And I was quite interested in this angle because, of course, we all struggle to hire software engineers. We all think it's a war for talent, et cetera, et cetera. But perhaps we're also overly skeptical of people who are moving into their careers as software engineers that maybe don't have the experience for us to say on a resume or CV or a GitHub profile or whatever, and we've got to take more chances. So I wonder what we need to do. Before I bring Diana on, I just want to go do a quick round robin on looking at junior devs. What are the signals that you would look for to say this is actually a high potential candidate based on, you know, based on what you've known as a recruiter or hiring manager? Amy, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, we're hiring on potential. We're not hiring you as an entry-level dev because of something you've already done. We're hiring you because we believe that you can learn and you can be taught and you can pick it up quickly and you're going to do something really cool a year or three from now. So yeah, we are looking for some signal that obviously you have the right, whether it's coursework, whether it's side projects, whether it's bootcamp, whatever. We want to look for those kind of fungible skills, but we're not necessarily looking for someone who's already built a system. So it's hiring on potential.
How do you do that? So their CV is like really raw. They may have graduated. Maybe their career conversion. You know, how would you signal? Well, what is the best thing to signal that potential? Is it a CV? Is it a telephone screen? Is it something else? You know, what is the best channel for us to figure this out?
It's all of it. I mean, you can't do it with just one of those things. You can't just look at a CV and say, okay, yeah, this is enough to make a decision. You have to put all the pieces together. It can be enough to decide if I want to get on the phone with the person. And then once I'm on the phone, I've got, okay, here's a resume. Here's the phone screen notes. Is it worth, you know, step three? And then step three is adding more. So we're kind of building a house here. We're laying the foundation with the CV. We're then building the phone screen on top of it and then the interview and so on. So, but it's also thinking about, and this is where hiring managers and recruiters really need to be in lockstep, is have we determined that, yes, we can afford to absorb a junior person who's going to need 6 to 9 months to ramp up, to learn the internal tools, to be in their first big kid job, you know, whatever that looks like, and know that we are investing in this because we're expecting a payoff in 18 to 24 months when they're actually in production and shipping features or whatever it might be.
Yeah. So dialogue with the team and hiring manager in the beginning is absolutely essential. They've got to accept the trade-offs again. They're going to get a high potential candidate, but you know what? It's going to be a certain period of time before this person is 100% productive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. Andy, go to you. Hiring junior dev, what are we looking at?
I mean, I couldn't agree more with hiring for potential instead of kind of looking for what they've done before. Obviously, the chances are either they've not experienced the things that you would like them to be accomplishing in a year or in two, whether that's because they're straight out of uni or because they're, like you said, Hung, they're slightly changing their career or whatever it is. But I think the potential kind of comes in both technically, so you can have like a good technical conversation with someone. It doesn't have to be about a specific technology or anything like that. It's more about being comfortable with ambiguity and kind of like talking around a problem, whatever that problem is. And that also includes kind of gauging how well the candidate is at communicating. So I think upskilling and learning is probably about 50-50 learning the thing and communicating. And if the candidate can't communicate well, then it's going to be quite a tough learning experience to get them up to the potential that we need them to get to in a year and a half, 2 years' time.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, the communication side is super important, right? I mean, we talk about hard technical skills and the requirements there, but most software, as far as I'm aware, is now collaboratively built. You know, your ability to actually interact with people, not only other technical people, but people in the business, that's critically important to your effectiveness as a pro programmer. Okay, great. Janko, go to you on this point. Junior devs, I know that, you know, at Elastic, maybe you don't do that given the nature of the business. But how would you, if there was a situation where you're hiring for someone who doesn't have a huge amount of experience, what is the kind of things that you'd be looking for from that person?
Well, in general, I guess it's the typical things that we're looking for. If they're really interested, if they might be already in the open source scene, looking at their GitHub profile as part of our usual process as well. So if somebody already contributed or did something in different open source works, and we can just send some of our senior engineers to look at that because it's all public, that already helps a lot. And then the typical, if they have specific energy and really drive to do what they want to do and can achieve stuff, sometimes you can see that quite easily as well. And we had some really junior people that did really great stuff for us because they already started in the university with our software, and then they got in touch basically, and it was just logical that they then directly can jump. But that's not the usual way that we deal with juniors yet. We're still working on that to get it in a better way as well.
No, it's great that you're prepared to be open with the journey you're on that side. And I guess Elastic might have some advantage in the sense, you know, it's a database. It's often used by a lot of people I would not say basic level, it's not the right word, but it's an easy to use database in the sense that it's very accessible to a large audience. So, you know, maybe you would get a lot of junior developers natively using it. And that could be a good source for candidates as well. Okay, I'm going to bring on a final guest, and that means I need to lose one of you because, again, the constraints of Crowdcast is that I can only get four people on screen at any one time. So Andy Lawson, because you've been on longest, I'm going to kick you off. Thank you very much for your time, man.
Thanks, everyone.
Really good chatting with you.
Thanks, Andy. Nice to see you.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah, really valuable to get your input. Let's catch up in Dalston. We'll go for a sausage roll up in Greg's at some point, yeah?
Let's do it.
Great. Take care, man.
Bye.
Cool. So actually, I want to bring on a lady called Diana Pavel, another lady I used to work with. Actually, I didn't work with her. She was just a good friend of mine. But she had the journey of kind of becoming a recruiter, then doing a crossover into development. And now I think she's found herself like building a community of junior devs. And I think this concept is really worth exploring because I think they do struggle to enter into the corporate marketplace for various reasons. I think there is a little bit of a stigma attached to people who've come and you know, crossed over doing coding courses and so on and stuff like that. There she is, Diana. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you. And wow, can I say I haven't seen you for a long time. Great to see you. Welcome back to the, I think you're still in the UK, right?
I am, yeah.
So, okay, we need to catch up in London. I know we meant to do a coffee and stuff, so we'll definitely do that. Way too long. Anyway, Diana, quickly, can you just introduce yourself and your journey and what it is you're doing right now?
Sure. So I've been working as a tech recruiter for about 5 years, 2.5 years in-house, 1.5 years in agency, and then I've been basically contracting with a few other tech companies. For the last 6 months, I did a coding course in Brazil. And then I came back to London, and because of this experience with working with junior developers, I decided that the best thing to do would be to create a community of software, like junior software developers, to meet senior software developers and CTOs and get advice. So it's basically a platform where they can find mentors. I also want to get some tech recruiters involved right at the beginning, because many junior developers don't really know how to approach building a profile, writing a CV, how to introduce themselves to companies. So it is, it's basically what I've been working on, not for a very long time. So please don't judge me on the website that you see if you click on it. I decided that after speaking to a lot of more senior developers that actually they want to give back to the community and they see it as a good initiative. I want to eventually make it more structured, but at the moment it's more of let's figure out what people actually need, so I don't go on building something that no one is actually going to use.
Yeah, well, I think it's been really warmly received, hasn't it? The entire idea. I read your blog post about this, and I think the sentiment is everyone's pointing in the same direction, in the sense that yes, we want more young talent into the tech world. You know, everyone's struggling to recruit, so we all want the same thing. Yeah. But there is a barrier, I think, to hiring crossover talent, if you like, or entry level talent, and so on. Why do you think that is, Diana? And why do you think sort of Workles or a product like this, or a kind of a community like this might help?
So I've identified two things so far. So not that many, but, you know, it's a start. One of them is that senior engineers and CTOs have a worry that not necessarily that the junior engineers will not really have good coding skills, but they will not necessarily know how to behave in a non-office environment. And I think that's true for absolutely all industries and jobs. It's not unique for the tech industry. But that's one, and it's quite big, because whenever I speak to a CTO and someone who doesn't really believe in the idea of hiring juniors, I always expect them to say, well, they're not going to be at that level technically, but it's usually the other thing, like they will not have great communication skills. And the second thing is that the tech industry is quite small. I feel like we think that it's big because we're in it and we've been in it for a very long time. But it's actually quite small, and most people get hired by knowing someone. And so two of the things that I want to do with Workles, one is to create a community around junior developers so they can actually meet their mentors. My sort of intuition tells me that eventually the mentors will want to hire the mentees, because they, you know, they're there, they know them, they're doing a great thing. It's almost like they're already half onboarded. And then the second thing will be that they will actually learn about office politics, as I call it, which, you know, many of them, like, obviously I've switched careers, so I kind of know what to expect, and I've been in tech before. But I think if you're completely new to it, there are a lot of different things that maybe you're not like fully aware of, which I think can go against you. Some of them are legitimate, like not having good communication skills, not being able to express yourself, not being able to you know, document your code or anything that is more technical? So if someone comes after you and they see what you created, will they be able to understand? And I think, you know, I did a coding bootcamp, and I think coding bootcamps, they are so intense. They focus on, you know, let's get something up and running quite quickly. I don't know if it's the same, you know, during engineering, like computer science degrees, but I've actually spoken to someone who's looking for an internship. So if anyone wants interns, I know the perfect person. I spoke to her today, and she mentioned the same thing. She said that, you know, we don't actually get prepared for office life. So in a way, these are the two things that I want to solve. One, how do we help these people understand what the office life might look like? You might not have that problem at Elastic. It's probably like a completely different like set of problems that you're encountering, you know, being fully distributed. And the second thing is, how do we create a community of people that can actually advocate for these junior engineers? Because we all know as recruiters that once you have two and a half, three years experience as an engineer, your career is basically, you know, you have so many offers, but it's crucial that we get them in when, you know, right at the beginning, and we train them properly.
Yeah, well, we all started somewhere, right? And I think your point you mentioned is super interesting on the community aspect of it, because a lot of it reminds me that the recruiting process itself is basically an attempt to growth hack a relationship. Yeah. You know, we're trying to figure out what this person is if they were working with us for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And all of these tests, assessments, coding, all these types of things are our attempt to figure that out in a slightly faster, more efficient way. But if you're able to kind of pre-build these relationships before hiring conversation takes place, then actually you cover a lot of the cultural fit stuff. You cover a lot of the problem, sort of solving problem questions that Andy was talking about earlier. You talked about communication before, Amy, as well. You know, all those other things that you try and do during a more structured recruiting funnel, actually you might achieve through perhaps even a more accurate, more organic way through this sense of community. Yanko, you just shared something that I think is worth exploring. You mentioned a talk there that you've obviously seen or watched. Can you just explain why you think this is interesting?
Yeah, because it's basically it's a woman from the Women Who Code and startup scene here in Barcelona, and basically a junior developer that herself was applying for different places, and she basically said a lot of good things and what exactly junior developers can also bring towards a crowd and a new customer base and company. So that's definitely very, very interesting to look at. And I was sitting there the first time I heard that in one of the meetups we have here, and I was thinking, yeah, we should be doing that, but we can't yet because we're just not at that stage where we can manage these kind of things. But definitely there's a lot of good things in there. And if you have the options to mentor somebody and to have somebody new with fresh ideas, yes, that's definitely also something worthwhile.
Yeah, fantastic. Listen, we're kind of well over time, so I just want to close this show off and leave sort of a final comment to all of you. I just want to say, look, there's a tech recruiter out there. They're struggling to assess a software engineer. What is the one piece of advice you'd give them to help them do this a little bit better? Amy, I go to you first.
Yeah, I think just focus on screening in. You just want to look for the signal that gets you to the next step. Don't worry if the person is hireable. Don't worry if they're going to accept your offer. Worry about getting them engaged and interested to take the next step and just build that house one brick at a time.
Love it. Screen in, not screen out. Love it, Amy. Okay, Yanko, go with you.
Yeah, on our side, basically, the recruiters are also always getting in contact with the tech teams and then having some second or third eyes to help them with the assessment if needed. And that's been a very good collaboration so far.
That's it. It's a team game. Don't isolate yourself as a recruiter. Don't absorb all the responsibility to do the tech assessment. You need support in doing that. And the technical team need to know that. And if they don't, they're actually going to load themselves up with more work down the line. Okay, cool. Diana, leave you the final word. How would you advise, I guess, your former self, you know, if you're a tech recruiter looking to assess and struggling to do that, what would your advice to that person be?
And I have definitely struggled with like lack of self-confidence a lot of the times. So I would say that maybe as a tech recruiter, we focus too much on the things that we don't know, and we should focus on the things that we do know and we're very good at. And that is understanding, you know, a person's motivations, and then leaving, obviously try to educate yourself as much as you can and ask as many dumb questions as you want and as you need to be better at your job. But ultimately, you know, understand that the person you're talking to has their own motivations and their own ideas about why they want to do something, why they want to come, you know, and work for your company. So focus on those things and leave everything that you don't know to other people.
That's a really, really good point. Focus on what you know, not what you don't. Okay, that's fantastic. And that's a wrap. Thank you, everyone, for your time and patience. Firstly, I want to give a big sort of a shout out to all of the 85 people that have jumped onto this live stream from the other live stream. So we lost about 200 people there. I'm really sorry about those folks. I will send everyone a recording of that of this this video. But thank you to the 85. You're the original gangsters to jump onto this to this live stream. Okay, that's it for us. A brilliant show. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Amy Miller. Brilliant to have you on the show. Janko Strasbourg again. We'll definitely get you back in for another round if you fancy it. Diana, welcome back to London. I will see you soon. Thanks everyone else for watching. It's been fantastic. Final word out to our sponsors, Codility. They are an online tech assessment platform. So if this is a problem for you or an issue that you're thinking about, definitely check them out, codility.com. Okay, we're back next week. We're going to be talking authentic job descriptions with Katrina Kibben. We will see you next week on Friday.
Bye.
Bye.